Welcome back to Feminist Book Club, the podcast. We're not just about feminist books. We are here for social justice, literature, and media in all its forms. But we do that through an intersectional feminist lens. Thanks for being here. Let's get started.
So hi, my name is Ashley. My pronouns are she, her, and I am joined today with Chanel Cleeton. Her pronouns are she, her. And we are here to talk about her latest novel, The House on Biscayne Bay. Chanel, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
So my first question for you is, what is your definition of feminism?
So for me, feminism really is about being inclusive and advocating for all women. Obviously, intersectionality is incredibly important with feminism, and particularly with what I write with historical fiction. You know, it's looking at women's roles in the past. It's honoring their contributions, their achievements. It's looking at, you know, the struggles they may have had. And also within, you know, those identities. As a Cuban-American woman, I write a lot about Cuban experiences and Cuban-American experiences in women throughout history.
Yes. And what is The House on Biscayne Bay about?
So The House on Biscayne Bay is a dual timeline story. It's set in 1918 and 1941, and it is two women whose lives are kind of transformed as they're living in this house, Marbrisa, that's on Biscayne Bay in Miami. And there's really kind of a tragedy that links the two women, and there's a lot of mystery surrounding the house. And so playing with the two timelines, I really like to kind of look at how you could find echoes of the past in the present and kind of unravel the mystery of this estate and what is really going on there.
Yes. So with Anna and Carmen, who are the two women, there's a lot of intuition that they have throughout the story. Just like, I'm not really sure about this. Should we keep going on with this? That really attributes to how they carry themselves amongst the characters and the story. So how did you write Anna and Carmen to hold these attributes? And how did you want them to have that procession throughout the story?
So Anna's voice really came to me first. She came to me very strongly, and it's not too much of a spoiler to give this away, but the book opens with her in 1918, and she's on this, you know, plot of land that her husband has decided to build this estate on. And he really hasn't told her anything about it. He's kind of been keeping it a secret. And you immediately get the sense of this lack of agency that Anna has in her marriage. And, you know, one thing I really like to write about, you know, when I've written quite a bit of historical fiction where, you know, I look at what women's lives are, both in terms of, you know, how much they're influenced by external political factors that are going on. So like if it's the Cuban Revolution, where it's something that's, you know, much larger and external going on outside the home that affects their lives, but also looking at personal relationships and really thinking about what it would have been like to be a woman in 1918, to be in a marriage where you wouldn't have a voice to necessarily make, you know, some of these objections or decisions, and you wouldn't really be an equal partner. You would kind of be treated as subordinate to your spouse. And so really looking at what that would feel like for a woman like Anna, you know, perhaps to still love her husband. And I think, you know, when it opens, you see that they do have a loving marriage, but obviously there's a power dynamic that is not equal in that. And you feel her frustration in that relationship. And so watching her kind of explore that as the house sort of takes on a life of its own and it becomes something that she's very worried about. As I mentioned, there's some events that happen at the house, not to spoil too much, but that kind of take on an ominous tone. And she really starts to have some concerns and some doubts about what's going on around her. And so I wanted to juxtapose that with the story of Carmen, who's coming from Cuba in 1941. She's lost her parents. Her sister is now living at Marbrisa with the sister's husband. And Carmen, much like Anna, is sort of thrown into this setting that she wasn't really expecting to be in. It's kind of a fish out of water experience for her. And she too realizes, you know, that something is going on in the house. She's much younger. And so you see kind of that difference, I think, in their life experiences and the way that they navigate the world around them in terms of the relationships that they have, and also in the time period. So in 1918, we have the end of World War I. And so there's kind of the sense that the world is changing. And I think Anna kind of left with this uncertainty of what's next. And she, like I said, doesn't necessarily have the agency to steer her family's fortunes because her husband is really controlling everything. So it's kind of like, how can she take that back in her own life? Whereas Carmen in 1941, I purposely set the book at a time period where you have World War II going on in Europe. The United States has not entered the war yet, but everyone kind of knows that something's brewing. And so Carmen really looks at it as a sense of, okay, there's going to be a great period of change. How can this be an opportunity for me to enter the workforce, to have a place for, myself and my life? And so both women have very much goals and dreams for themselves, and they're caught up in the story of this house. So it's really the personal struggle and also kind of the external of what's going on at Marbrisa.
And it doesn't, what I loved about both of the characters is that they're not naive and that anything that they have to learn, they learn quickly. So that it's survival instinct. It's okay, I've been around this situation long enough to know, paired with the intuition that, okay, this is not going to work out. Who can I trust? Can I, how do I rely on myself so that I don't get caught up in the life of this house and what has happened.
Very much. And that's something I think I'm drawn to with historical fiction. I started writing historical fiction. My debut, Next Year in Havana, was really inspired by my family's experiences in Cuba. They fled Cuba after the revolution. They came here as refugees. And just thinking about what my grandmother's life was like living through, such tumultuous times where there was so much uncertainty and insecurity. And seeing those narratives kind of crop up again and again in history, we see these examples of women doing extraordinary things, either on, a larger, more public level, or just within their individual lives of going on in these very difficult environments. And so I wanted both Carmen and Anna to have agency, because I think that's very much reflected in the historical narratives that we see. There's always, I think, some people who kind of try to argue, like, oh, women wouldn't have had those thoughts back then. And absolutely they did. Women have been taking care of things for a long time, and we definitely see that.
Absolutely. And the world building in this story is incredible. It's mostly set at Marbrisa, but Miami is such a character, and the bay, and just all that comes together. So, what is consistent about the setting throughout your novels, and what is unique about this novel setting?
So that's a great question. This book is a little bit of a departure for me. With my historical fiction, a lot of my books have really centered on either large political events like the Cuban fight for independence or the revolution. And so it is a bigger stage. You're going to different places, you're seeing large world events affecting the characters in the novel a bit more. With this book in particular, I wanted to do something different for my readers. And also just kind of exploring sort of the natural architecture and landscape of Miami, I felt like it really lent itself to kind of this Gothic mansion. And so, as you said, much of the novel, the vast majority of it, is really centered at this house. But it really kind of puts my characters in such a close proximity that it sort of forces them to work out some of the issues that they have or confront things that, are right there. So the immediacy of it, I think, really adds to both the character development and kind of the pacing with the plot in terms of the fact that it is sort of like a locked room mystery, and that everyone's in this house kind of trying to get out at different points.
And my final question for you is, why did you title the house Marbrisa?
So I was trying to think of words that I could kind of put together to make an estate name in Spanish that would sort of capture the spirit of the house. And so the idea of taking, the word for sea and breeze and kind of putting that together, I thought it gave the spirit of kind of standing on at the water's edge and standing on the edge of the bay and what that would feel like for you. I played around with a few different kind of combinations, and that just felt like something that stuck for the house for me. And so I liked that.
And when I looked up what Marbrisa meant, it means sea breeze. But something else that came up that was intriguing to me was that it's also called the truth. It said, Yo soy el aire, la brisa y el mar. And that translated to the truth, which really is impactful for the story. I don't know if that was your int if that was an intention or something that you noticed.
So that was not my specific intent, but I did want to, like I said, kind of honor the landscape and the feeling of where you are. But I love that as well.
Yes. So Chanel Cleeton, thank you for joining us to talk about the house on Biscayne Bay.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're excited to tell you about a new release from Broadleaf Books, a publisher of books on social justice, society and culture, personal growth, spirituality, and more. The book is We Refuse to Be Silent, Women's Voices on Justice for Black Men, edited by Angela P. Dodson. This powerful and needed essay collection brings together 35 accomplished women writers on the topic of violence and injustice against Black men. These writers are journalists, authors, scholars, ministers, psychologists, counselors, and more. They are also wives, mothers, sisters, daughters, aunties, and friends. Each lends her voice to shine a new light on the injustices and dangers Black men face daily, and how women feel about the vulnerability of our sons, husbands, brothers, fathers, uncles, friends, and other males we care about as they navigate a world that often stereotypes and targets them. Contributors include Elizabeth Alexander, author of The Light of the World, Brenda M. Green, founder and executive director of the Center for Black Literature, Isabel Wilkerson, Pulitzer Prize-winning author, Michelle Duster, great-granddaughter of Ida B. Wells, Kianga Yamada Taylor, editor of How We Get Free, and Darnella Frazier, the citizen journalist who filmed the murder of George Floyd, plus many more. The catalyst for a national conversation, We Refuse to Be Silent, offers historical context that is often missing from public discussions and media coverage, while demonstrating an ongoing pattern of demonizing Black men that is rooted deep in the history of our nation. The women have something to say. Are you listening? You can pre-order We Refuse to Be Silent at broadleafbooks.com. Till then, happy reading, and thanks to Broadleaf Books for sponsoring this episode.
Hi, my name is Nox Quiroz. My pronouns are she, her, hers, and today I will be talking about The No Girlfriend Rule by Kristen Randall, and also about being a woman in TTRPGs. First of all, if you don't know what TTRPG is, that's okay. TTRPG stands for Tabletop Role-Playing Game, and if you've heard of Dungeons & Dragons, that's the most well-known one. But my name is Nox, and I've been playing TTRPGs since July of 2022. I've been in a number of campaigns, playing a number of systems, and I've been a player, and I've also been a GM or a game master, so like the person helping construct the tale without being like a player. I say help construct because the cool thing about TTRPGs is just how much players construct the stories. I can say as a GM, I started both of my campaigns with, yes, this is how it's going to go. And then my players are like, but what if we do this? And honestly, they changed it for the better. That's the best part, is when the player's like, but if we do this, and you know what? That's a great idea. Like my School of the Stars campaign, one of them was like, but what if my character was dead the whole time? And I was like, go on. And it made the story that much better. So last year, my friend Kay tweeted me and was like, hey, this book seems right up your alley. And it was The No Girlfriend Rule. Book wasn't out yet, but the description was fat main character, anxious main character, joins a group, an all-girl group of essentially D&D, but S&S in this world, and finds community and also herself. And if that's not the most me kind of book that can exist... Kay was like, listen, I think you'll eat this up. And this seems like the most Nox thing that I can imagine. And it was, in fact, the most Nox thing you can ever imagine. I really do sometimes feel like this book was written specifically for me. Like, as I was reading it, I was like, oh, I love this. And I was just so excited. And it made me want to eat more than I already do want. It made me want a group of people to play a home game with. I love this book, but also this book made me incredibly frustrated because it reminded me of so much toxicity inside of the TTRPG community. And we really went swinging from the first chapter to let you know this was a thing. From homophobia, from racism, bioessentialism, and sexism, and ableism. And a lot of people, mainly shown by Hollis's first group of friends, her boyfriend Chris and that group of friends, go, that's just how it is. Oh, a guy playing a bard was creepy? Yeah, it's a bard. That's what bards are like. And as someone who has played a bard, that is not how bards are. Ugh. So frustrating. Okay. That's just how it is. Goblins are just inherently evil. Things like that. And going, well, that's just how the game is. And I was incredibly frustrated, and I could feel, I felt the frustration and anger alongside Hollis, probably more so because I knew that that wasn't how things have to be. And then she sees the poster for the SNS game with the girls, and she takes it from the first Discord chat where their story master, Gloria, goes, "Hey, I'm going to be writing out some things to make this more inclusive." It warmed my heart. Like, as someone who has, like, friends who are very much about, like, yeah, rule book, but also it's more of a guideline because you can make things more accessible and inclusive to, you know, people I know and love writing supplements and things like that to add to these worlds, or, you know, friends going, I didn't like this one thing, so this is how I made it more inclusive to the fact that a battle wheelchair exists. There's like a somebody wrote up what a battle wheelchair and its stats and everything could be. It showed both the horrible, horrible side of people being like, that's just how it is. It's fine to do things like that, to not get player consent before you try to seduce another player's character. And it was so frustrating to see someone go, I'm going to roll to seduce your character because I have a plus 10 to persuasion. I actually put the book down and screamed. And it was the first chapter. Seeing the group that Hollis joins and the community that she finds in that group made me cry because of how important the community that I have found through TTRPGs is. I really want to shout out the group that got me into TTRPGs, because I was very lucky to start by playing with a femme-led group. I started playing in a campaign called Harsh Realms that unfortunately has never been finished, and will hopefully one day we will finish it, on a channel called Girls Run These Worlds. And Girls Run is woman-led, femme-led, and really cares about making things as inclusive and accessible as possible. Some of our tables may have masked people or non-binary people or just male identifying people, but it's predominantly femme-led and women-led. My experience there was so safe, to the point that when I left and had an unsafe experience, another safe experience at that production company kept me feeling like I can keep doing this. And I have since branched out a bit. I still go back to Girls Run. It's still my home. I'm still in the Discord server like every day. My first campaign that I ever GM'd was on Girls Run. It's home. Without that table, without Girls Run in general, I don't think I would have gotten to do half of the amazing things that I have done since. Like, I went to another channel and I've run an all disabled superhero table, and we're on our second season right now, and I don't think I would have had the confidence or just the ability to go, things can be okay, if it wasn't for the fact that I had started on Girls Run. But I really wanted to shout them out for making me feel so safe and for being my home. When my gramps died last year, so many people from that community came and supported me and checked on me. When I was worried if I was doing something wrong in a campaign, when I was worried about, you know, whether or not I can do this because the anxiety will always be part of it, the community there really uplifted me. If you're a woman who wants to join TTRPGs, I want you to know that there are things that happen, horrifying things that can happen, and sometimes people excuse, but I also want you to know that there are places that are warm and full of love. And the reason I'm specifically shouting out Girls Run is because they are a femme-led space, but there are multiple production companies that I've been a part of that have been amazing experiences, like the one I'm currently running my show on right now. Like, there are several, but I also wanted to shout out Hordes of Tales, because this month, because it's Women's History Month, they are doing their Women in Gaming month of all femme tables and having panels talking about being a woman in TTRPG space. And so I also wanted to shout out that event is happening and will be happening for the rest of the month. Those are the two main women-led things I can think of right now. If you have any questions, always hit me up, because I know a couple of production companies. But I just wanted to reiterate that space exists, and we always need more people who love telling stories and want to see more inclusive and accessible spaces. The No Girlfriend Rule, I highly recommend, especially if you are someone who is looking for that community. You might want to throw the book a couple of times because of how incredibly bigoted people can get. But also the heart of it is community and love. Women supporting women. We love that. We love to see that. With that said, I'm going to sign off. Nat 20s for you all. Goodbye.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of Feminist Book Club, the podcast. Want to be part of the club? Here's how you can join us. Obviously, subscribe to our podcast and leave a rating and review for brownie points. Follow along on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, Pinterest, and TikTok. All of those links are in the show notes. Sign up for our newsletter to be the first to know what our next monthly book pick is. And check out our award-winning monthly book subscription service. Oprah Magazine named it one of their favorite book boxes, and Shonda Rhimes called us one of her favorite subscription boxes in general. There are multiple membership levels for any budget, and it's an excellent way to support the show and the voices you heard today. See you in the club.
A well-read woman is a thing.